As you know, we've been talking about life in the kingdom. We've been looking at the Sermon on the Mount, which is Jesus' inaugural address as he introduces his kingdom. And we've said that his kingdom is somewhat quite a bit different than other kingdoms that the folks were familiar with. Matter of fact, it was completely different from what they were expecting. They thought Messiah would come to usher in a new physical kingdom, an actual realm in which he would overthrow Rome and establish a throne there in Jerusalem and have a physical, visible kingdom. And Jesus comes and says, no, it's not really that kind of a kingdom. It's a spiritual kingdom. And if I am your king, then you're a part of my kingdom, and I reign and rule in your life. And the kingdom that he introduces to us in the great Sermon on the Mount is an internal spiritual kingdom. And last week we looked at a statement that he made in chapter 5 at verse 20. He made a very interesting and challenging statement. He said, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven." He said, in order to be a part of my kingdom, your righteousness has to surpass that of the scribes and Pharisees. And we talked about how we can't do that. We can't keep the law and surpass the righteousness of the legal experts on our own. And what he's saying is, you need my righteousness. You need my grace. Let me come in and forgive you, and I will give to you my righteousness. You'll be justified is the term. It means to be made right in God's eyes. That's how we have a righteousness that surpasses them. But this morning, I want us to look at the context of what he says there, because as soon as he makes that statement, your righteousness must surpass the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees. As soon as he says that, he gives us six examples of how a kingdom citizen's righteousness can surpass the righteousness of a Pharisee. As Jesus is king and he begins to work in our lives, he begins that process that we call sanctification, that process of making us more and more like him. As that begins to happen, the kingdom citizen is able to have a righteousness that is even deeper and more meaningful than that of the Pharisees. The reason is their righteousness is external. It's all about keeping the rules. It's about doing the right things and wearing the right clothes and eating the right foods. For the kingdom citizen in Christ's kingdom, righteousness is internal. That's actually a greater righteousness. You see, someone can have an evil heart. They can be selfish. They can be rude and arrogant and mean, and still show up for church and put their offering on the altar and do the right things. And on the outside, it looks righteous, but on the inside, they're all messed up. And so God says, "You know what? That's not a righteousness that pleases me." Christ then talks about a righteousness that is greater, so that in my heart I'm worshiping already, and I demonstrate that by bringing my offering to the altar. You see, instead of the outside being shown, it's more about the reality on the inside that winds up being demonstrated on the outside. Does that make sense? The kingdom is about internal realities instead of external demonstrations. You see, the Pharisees' righteousness is external. Ours is internal. Theirs is doing right. Ours is about being right. Jesus calls us to a righteousness that goes beyond legalism to loving, beyond ritual to relationship, beyond self to sacrifice, beyond tradition to truth, beyond the letter of the law to the spirit of the law. In other words, Jesus focuses not on actions but on attitudes, not on behavior but on belief, not on conduct but on character, not on deeds but on desires. He demonstrates this with six comparisons between the Pharisees' standard and Jesus' standard. And as he goes through these six comparisons, he uses the formula, "You have heard, but I say to you." Six times. We're going to look at four of them this morning. He says, "You have heard it said this or that, but I say to you something new." He brings his own authority to it. And one of the reasons he does this when he says, "You have heard this or that," is he knows that some of what the folks have heard is Old Testament law. Remember, everybody couldn't go to Mardell and pick out a leather-bound Bible to carry with them. They had to be taught what it said. Somebody had to tell them what was there. And some of what they had heard was actually Old Testament law. Some of what they heard, and probably most of what they heard, was actually the traditions that had developed through the scribes and Pharisees, those traditions that had developed that were based on interpretations of what the Old Testament law actually said. So Jesus didn't sort out, you know, this was the Old Testament law, this is what the Pharisees said, they got this wrong. He didn't mess with all that. He just said, "I know you've heard this, but now I say to you this." Let's look at four comparisons in which he uses that format to demonstrate to us that kingdom living is a heart issue. It's all about what's going on in you as a person, not about what you show others or do on the outside. The first comparison that he makes is that between murder and anger. Look with me at verse 21. We're in Matthew chapter 5 at verse 21. "You have heard that the ancients were told, 'You shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court.'" Now that is the sixth commandment, isn't it? Thou shalt not commit murder. It's the sixth commandment. And if you do, then you have a right to, not a right, but I should say then you deserve to stand before a judge and be tried for the crime of murder. All right? And so he says, "You've heard, you should not commit murder. Whoever does commit murder shall be liable to the court." You'll be brought to the judge. "But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And whoever shall say to his brother, 'Raca.'" Raca means empty head, nitwit. You insult someone in that way. "Everyone who says to his brother, 'Raca,' shall be guilty before the Supreme Court." Most likely talking about the Sanhedrin. "And whoever shall say, 'You fool,' shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. If therefore you're presenting your offering at the altar and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your offering there before the altar and go your way. First be reconciled to your brother and then come and present your offering." He says very clearly, "You've heard it said, don't commit murder. But I'm telling you that when God wrote that law, he was trying to get you to see something deeper and more meaningful. He was trying to get you to see the anger and hatred in your heart. And so it's not really about the act of murder. It's about within your heart holding on to that hatred for someone. That's the spirit of the law. And so he says, you know, it's not just if you kill someone, but if you're angry with them, if you insult them, you call them empty head or fool, well, then you're committing the same thing that God was trying to teach us against. Within your heart, you are belittling the life of another. You're holding that hatred, and that hatred is controlling your behavior. It's very similar to what we read in 1 John 3:15. Anyone who hates a brother or sister is a murderer, because it's the sin of the heart that we're concerned about. Anger and contempt are so serious that Jesus demanded an immediate action to avoid them and to replace them with a proper attitude. He said, when you recognize in your heart that anger, that contempt, when you see it there, do something fast to fix it. And he gives two examples of how we need to take care of that problem immediately, quickly. The first one I just read for you. If you come to church and you're bringing your offering to the altar and you realize that that you've got a problem with someone, you go and take care of that problem right away. Go and take care of it right then. It's more important for you to be right with men so that you can be right with God than it is for you to present this image in front of everybody of everything's okay and I'm making my offering and I'm a religious person. No, you go and get right with others so you can be right with God. That's what's going to matter the most. The second example that he gives of how important it is to take care of this immediately when we find it in our heart, deal with it right away. The first one is when you're bringing something to the altar, go take care of it. The second one is verse 25. Make friends quickly with your opponent at law while you are with him on the way, in order that your opponent may not deliver you to the judge and the judge to the officer, you be thrown in prison. Truly I say to you, you shall not come out of there until you have paid up the last cent. He says, man, don't wait for it to go to trial. Fix it. Deal with it. When you see something in your heart, you see anger, you see contempt, you see that hatred in your heart, fix it immediately. Don't wait for a judge to sort it out later. Don't keep on pretending that you're... Fix it. It's that important. He says the Pharisees' righteousness says don't murder, but you can still hate. You can look down on people. You can have contempt. You can have anger if you want to. Just don't kill anybody. And he says, but I'm telling you something deeper, more meaningful, more powerful. I'm telling you what the commandment was really all about. You fix it in your heart. If it's fixed in your heart, you won't do the murder anyway. You see, kingdom living is a heart issue. The second comparison that he makes between their righteousness and his is adultery and lust. Look at verse 27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. That's the seventh commandment. You shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman to lust for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. You see, adultery is committed in our hearts and minds. This is where the act of adultery really begins. If we're going to keep God's law, we have to deal with our internal motives and desires and intents. This is where we lose the battle, not in our behavior. We lose the battle first before we act. We lose the battle in our mind and in our hearts. And so he says, you protect that and get that right first. If you don't handle it internally, soon it will be external. You remember he followed his teaching about murder with two examples? He does the same thing here. Two examples that teach us that it's important to take care of this issue immediately, quickly. He's going to show us how important it is to deal with this issue of the heart with two examples. Look at verse 29. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you that one of the parts of your body perish than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand makes you stumble, Cut it off. Throw it from you. For it is better for you that one of the parts of your body perish than for your whole body to go into hell. Golly! He's saying, poke your own eye out. Chop your hand off. What in the world is he talking about? Let me give you an example that I think, hopefully, will clarify this just a little bit. Yesterday, my lovely wife and my beautiful daughter dragged me all over Canton. And I'm telling you, there were a million people in Canton yesterday. And hot, you could fry an egg on my head. And all we saw was junk. We saw more junk. All the junk that was there, Fred Sanford would have had an actual heart attack. Out of all that junk, I only saw two Dr. Pepper things. And they were priced so high, Oprah would have had to take out a loan to buy them. Now, what did I do? Were there really a million people in Canton? Probably not. Probably just 900,000, and they all thought they had to bump into me. Was it really hot enough to fry an egg on my head? No, but you got the point. Right? Was there really that much junk? Well, yeah, but as soon as you heard a million people, you knew what I was doing is called hyperbole. It's an exaggeration to make a point. You knew there was not a million people there, but it felt like a million people. You knew it wasn't that hot. Actually, yesterday was pretty nice, but you knew it wasn't that hot, but you got the point through my exaggeration, right? That's what Jesus is doing here. It's a part of grammar. It's a way of speech. It's a hyperbole. He's exaggerating the point so that we get the point. And he's saying adultery happens in the mind and the heart, and it is so serious. Take it seriously and do whatever you have to do to get it out of your life. If that means you pluck out your eye or you unplug the computer, you do what you have to do to get it out of your life. And you do it immediately. That's his point. He uses hyperbole to say, clean the heart, because kingdom living is a heart issue. Jesus is not about religion and ritual. He's about relationship and reality. He's about being real with him. It's too easy for us to say, I can think and feel and believe anything I want because that's in secret. As long as I show up and throw God a bone by being religious on Sunday, I've got it. Jesus says, you're not part of the kingdom. Kingdom people understand that kingdom living is a heart issue. The third comparison that he makes to help us understand this is the comparison of divorce and marriage. Look at verse 31. And it was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife except for the cause of unchastity makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. The rabbis had made ending a marriage a trivial thing. What happened was In the Old Testament time, it got to where men were not honoring women. And they would very easily, very flippantly say, "We're done. Get out. No big deal. Get out of here." And so the law addressed that problem. And the law says, if you're going to divorce your wife, you do it in a way that will protect her in this society that we have that kind of looks down on divorced women, looks down on single women, that doesn't provide opportunities for them to take care of themselves. You provide a way, you at least take the time to fill out a certificate that verifies why she's not with you anymore. You at least do that much. Is that God saying it's okay for divorce? No, God never says that. God says if you're going to choose divorce, here's a way that you can do it that will protect this lady in a society that otherwise would just eat her alive. Now, in that context, he mentions, in the Old Testament, it mentions this certificate of divorce. Well, the rabbis picked up on that certificate of divorce. And over time, it changed from protecting the woman to, in Jesus' day, it had gone back to really mistreating the woman, because it would say, all you have to do is fill out a form and then she's gone. No, they missed the point completely. But that's where they were in Jesus' day. You fill out a form, you make a certificate, and it's easy as pie. All you have to do is prove that she did something wrong, even to the point of, if she didn't cook dinner correctly, then you could fill out a certificate and she'd be on her way. It doesn't matter that it's hard for her, she can't get a job. It doesn't matter that she can't take care of herself. None of that matters. If she burns your toast, she's gone. So Jesus says, you've heard it said, you fill out a certificate and it's okay. But I say to you that that's not what God had in mind at all. I say to you that if you do that, if you divorce her, you're putting her in a position where she commits adultery. And he says the only time that divorce in this case would be acceptable is if the other partner has really already divorced you by their actions. They've really already committed adultery, thereby they divorced you to begin with. So what Jesus is saying is we need a high standard by which we value marriage. And that happens here. That happens in the heart. A piece of paper, a certificate that takes care of it, that's external. That's the Pharisees' righteousness. At least give her a piece of paper. That's a pretty low standard of righteousness. Jesus has a higher standard of righteousness, and he said, let's value marriage. Unless the other person has already broken the marriage, don't you break it. Let's value that marriage. It's a higher level of righteousness. He shows us what God's law originally intended to protect and honor marriage. It's not about loopholes. And the interesting thing is that even though this Sermon on the Mount is all about internals, people still go here and treat it legally. They still go to this text to find the loophole that they can find, and they treat what he says here as law. The point is, kingdom living is a heart issue. It's not about the loopholes. It's about an internal commitment to God and his plan. Well, the fourth comparison that he makes that shows us kingdom living is a hard issue is the comparison of oaths and truth. Look at verse 33. Again, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. What he's referring to is a very interesting and intricate system of vows. If you said, I swear on my mama's grave, then someone would assume that you're about to really tell the truth, because you wouldn't dishonor Mama and her grave. So you said, I swear on Mama's grave. That tells us you're about to really tell the truth. They had a whole system of these things. And the scribes and the Pharisees wound up deciding which ones were actually binding and which ones weren't. Those in which you said you used God's name, I swear to God, that one was binding. But others where you didn't actually use his name, I swear on the altar, not quite so binding. I mean, it got so particular and so nitpicky, if you will, that if you swore by Jerusalem, not binding. If you swore toward Jerusalem, binding. The difference of a preposition. You had to keep your word with certain ones, but the others, you didn't really matter quite so much. What were they doing? They were finding ways to cross their fingers. They were finding ways to say stuff. But I had my fingers crossed. It doesn't really count. He says, you've heard. The ancients were told, you shall not make false vows, but shall fulfill your vows to the Lord. Those that used his name, fulfill those. But I say, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Nor shall you make an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. But let your statement be yes, yes, or no, no. And anything beyond this is of evil. He says, you know, if you swear on Jerusalem, it's still about God because that's the king city. If you swear by the altar, that's still about God because that's where we worship him. You swear by the earth, that's still about him, that's his footstool. So instead of playing these games, instead of pretending that some oaths don't count and some do, how about this? How about we just tell the truth? Let's try that, Pharisees. You see, he calls us to a righteousness that is higher than the Pharisees' righteousness. They say there are ways that you can kind of get by with telling half-truths and lies. Jesus says, why play those games? Why have to remember what you said? Just tell the truth. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. Don't worry about oaths. Don't. You know, you've seen it. Perhaps you've done it. You say something and somebody doesn't believe you and you say, I swear on a stack of Bibles. Well, you know, if you always told the truth and people understood that you told the truth, you wouldn't have to swear on the stack of Bibles. You wouldn't have to swear to God. We would just know you're a truth teller. So Jesus says, kingdom citizens, don't play games where we take vows and pretend and cross our fingers and just tell the truth. It's a heart issue. It's not an external thing based on what you're vowing against. It's just your heart. Tell the truth, be truthful, and you don't have to worry about it. Let your yes be yes, your no be no. And you know one of the benefits of that is, I alluded to it a while ago, one of the benefits of that is you don't have to remember what you said. You don't have to remember what story you told who. You just tell the truth and it's always the truth and you're covered. Jesus says it's about the heart. It's not about murder as an act. It's about the anger that was there to begin with. It's not about adultery as an act. It's about the lust that was there to begin with. It's not about divorce per se. It's about the commitment to God's plan to begin with. It's not about the oaths. It's about truth within. Kingdom living is a heart issue. And with that, I finish with Proverbs 4. Above all else, guard your heart. For everything you do flows from it.